Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, where we discuss the latest DevOps news, AWS announcements, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A that you can't find anywhere else. It's September 17th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse sells AWS reference architectures that get you production ready in just 2 weeks. So if you're curious to learn more about that, just go to cloudposse.com. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format's very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos, this is a great place to ask. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us live by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. We'll send you an invite so you can attend every week. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, please share it with your team. That's how we spread the wealth of knowledge that we have here. So you'll find the recording at youtube.com/cloudposse, and we'll be posting a recording of today's session in a few hours. So with that said, let's see what caught my attention this week here. First one, this is a cool little CLI tool written by Suzuki. If you haven't checked out Suzuki on GitHub, he just has a little treasure trove of CLIs that do awesome stuff. So check that out. So what is this about? Hold on, I'm just trying to figure out why I can't move my Zoom window around here. Okay, so what is this about? Well, if you've been using the GitHub CLI, which is awesome, by the way, one of the really nice things with the GitHub CLI is that you can run a command gh auth token. That command will output your current session token. And if you set that as like your GitHub token, it'll work with any GitHub CLI that uses the standard SDK convention of using GitHub underscore token. But there's a problem with that. And if you are a developer on your workstation using that, you are exposing yourself to a lot of risk, actually, because that token is not scoped to a repository that you're working on, to even the organization you're in. And if you're in a lot of different organizations, that's a big liability. So it's actually kind of surprising that you can't do this with the native GitHub CLI. But when you see what this setup is involved, I kind of get it. So to make this work, he is taking advantage of a cool feature of GitHub apps. GitHub apps are the equivalent of service accounts on GitHub, and they can be used programmatically to get a token with a certain scope for a certain amount of time. The issue is that they're a pain in the butt to work with unless you're doing it programmatically. So that's what this does. What you do is you start by creating your own GitHub app for your own account, let's say, and pretty much any developer can do that. GitHub reserves app names with your username. So you can create, like, my username on GitHub is Osterman. So I can just create a Osterman app. And now I can issue tokens for my Osterman app. Next thing is that you're gonna have some master credentials still for accessing that GitHub app. And those can be secured by sticking them in your keychain. So it natively supports keychain access to do that. Next, anytime you need a token, you're going to use the GitHub token CLI to retrieve a short-lived scope token based on a config file that you can have in your current context that you're working in. And this is really nice because it can be scoped across multiple repositories, I believe, in the organization. And if you are, using Claude Code, this is probably a good idea because, during that session, it has access to it, whatever you have access to. So if you're working in a repository and you're only using this and you don't log in with a GitHub CLI, so that token is invalid, you can't use it, then this protects you pretty nicely. Curious if anybody else saw this, took a look, have tried it out yet? Or if you have any questions on why this is necessary and a nice improvement from a security perspective.
I have not, but it does look like something that is very useful for some of the operations I don't want to do, so.
Yeah, I have to say it's put me at a dis ease, not disease, knowing that like using tools like Cursor or Cloud Code, it has all that access. And this would make me feel a little bit better, shy of creating like virtual sandboxes that I'd be using for any of the vibe coding. Something definitely needs to be solved here. I have
You're
seen.
really surprised that GitHub doesn't offer this functionality out the box. Like, this should be native, you would think.
Yeah, it really should be. It really should be.
I
Let's
wonder what set of permissions that it has available to, because that's just the GitHub underscore token that is provided to Actions as well, right?
Well, so the con you, I think you're familiar with the AWS ecosystem, canonical environment variables for SDK access are AWS SecretID, AWS Access Token. In the GitHub ecosystem, this is that token. Now, what that token is, well, that could come from a GitHub app, that could come from the GitHub CLI, that can come that used to be a personal access token, which was static. This is now creating it from GitHub apps. All right. Next, Cursor feeling the heat from all the love getting Cloud Code's getting and Codex. They have their own CLI. Codex being by OpenAI. So now Cursor has a desktop CLI that you can leverage as well. I haven't had a chance to try it out yet. I thought I would totally hate on the CLI experience for vibe coding, but it's turned out to be very productive for me. All right, so the most interesting thing that came up this week was a post by Terra Team. And I have so I don't want to take so I'm a little skeptical on the maturity or where it's at right now, though then again I haven't put in my email there. It sounds a little bit like, where you create a launch page of something super cool that everybody wants and then you go build it, which is a great approach. Like, it passes the mom test. You shouldn't build things that you haven't found a buyer for. And this has been a very popular post. In fact, it's one of the few posts that actually ranks on Hacker News. It's really hard for any post on Hacker News to get above one point. This actually was, last I checked, up to 50 points or so. All right. So what is this? I had to I had so at first glance, yes, totally love it, like it, want it. But I had to grapple with it for a long time before I really could understand how this could work or why it's possible. So what is it? So as you know, Terraform supports state backends. State backends are a function of the Terraform core, OpenTofu core. There is an RFC to make this pluggable in OpenTofu, but not yet implemented, I believe. And Terraform has natively supported a bunch of types, right? So you have an S3 backend, Google Cloud Storage backend, an OCI backend for contain no, I mean for Oracle Cloud, and then a remote backend, which is what they implemented for Terraform Cloud originally. Now, a lot of providers have used that backend for remote state and implemented their own implementations. You can self-host them and so forth. So the first piece of this puzzle is, what they've done is created a new backend using the Terraform remote type that speaks the remote protocol but stores the state in a Postgres database as a graph. And each node, each resource is a row in that database. So far, pretty cool. Just that alone, having your state in there, but you can kind of do that already, right? Because there's a Postgres plugin, or not plugin, there's a Postgres backend for Terraform. But here's the difference. When you use that backend for Terraform, it's still just storing a blob of JSON in the Postgres database. And yeah, okay, so Postgres supports like indexing on JSON objects, and you could probably do some cool stuff with that anyways, and it's still a step up, but it's still not as nice as if you had a relational database in Postgres with your entire graph. So that's part of what this does. The next problem that they're getting into, and I believe I've seen other posts from Terra Team and others, is tackling a problem that's front of mind more and more by a lot of companies and teams, which is this whole problem of large-scale Terraform. And that means a lot of things to different people. And scale is relative to your company, right? And what you do. But let's say, you know, when the amount of Terraform code and the graph size under management, you know, grows into the thousands or tens of thousands of resources, things, problems start to happen. You hit API rate limits, you use up like 25 gigs of RAM just to run a Terraform plan. You run into more transient errors and so forth. And this is kind of a problem with the way Terraform was implemented. There are a few strategies right now for how this is being addressed. One of those is a strategy we've been taking for a long time at Cloud Posse, which is you break this Terralytic architecture into smaller components, and you manage the life cycle of those components independently. And this works really well with vanilla Terraform out of the box, but it introduces some rough edges, which is that, well, you lose some of the nice benefits of Terraform being able to compute the graph. So an alternate school of thought is evolving, which is, what if we actually embrace the Terralith, but we design it in a certain way where the pieces of that Terralith are isolated, more or less, and there are loose connections maybe between pieces in that Terralith. But let's say, what is a Terralith in this case? You have like a VPC, you have an EKS cluster, and they have some loose relationships there. But for the most part, EKS is separate from VPC. So in this model, you can target parts of your Terralith, right? You can target the VPC and just apply that. You can target the EKS cluster and just apply that. The problem is with Terraform is you're still locking the entire state file. And this breaks down in a team environment where lots of people are trying to modify the same parts of code. So now it's suddenly a Terraform state backend problem. Well, what if instead we could strategically lock parts of the Terraform state so that teams could work concurrently on that Terraform state? And only modify the parts that they modify. And where they do happen to modify overlapping parts, well, then the graph is still locked, and it's, you know, what we had, the problem we had before, but it mitigates a lot of the problems. So this is the problem that it solves, state graph. So they've implemented a remote state capable backend. They've implemented a thin wrapper for Terraform, which handles the locking semantics of the resource affected by this graph. And therein lies this mental this conundrum that I had, and that I was grappling with to try and fully understand this. Because Terraform does something pretty interesting. Yes, it computes, yes, it has a state or a record of what your previous state was, and then it computes a plan for what your future state will look like, and then it reconciles those. But it also does something like a three-way merge, which is compares that with what's deployed on the cloud. And this is why I was grappling, like, how could this actually speed anything up if the slowest part of the whole puzzle is still querying the cloud? And the best reconciliation I could come up with is that this isn't trying to solve that. This is still strictly trying to solve, when you are targeting parts of your graph, can you speed that up and still ensure you have proper locking in place? And that's why this can work quite nicely if you use this. And then if they implement this, and then OpenTofu comes out with pluggable backends, then you probably don't even need the CLI wrapper, and this becomes a new pretty interesting solution. Has anyone taken a deeper look at this, grokking it better than I am, or any corrections you want to make based on what I've described here, or other interesting things? Or That was a long explanation for a pretty complicated concept.
This is the first I'm seeing of this. Oh, it feels like reporting. This would make reporting a lot easier, eh? Because instead of having a massive JSON file to pore over, now you have individual control over rows. You can split out, join. Is that the idea?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of tangential benefits by going this route. And then you can leverage the whole Postgres permissions model on this, and you can create reports on top of it. So, I mean, there are derivative benefits by having your state in a SQL database fully, denormalized like this.
Right. Because, yeah, it seems like performance isn't their main priority in this one, really, is it? It's not going to suddenly speed up Terraform. It's more with how you handle the existing data you have.
Well, kind of. It will speed things up, but a select subset of the problems in a
Right.
practical way. So this is the area where, from a team perspective, by the way, this is by a company called Terra Team. They're one of the many tacos out there. Terra Team Digger, Scalyr, Spacelift, TerraMate, and the list. And there's probably 10 more. I saw another one on Reddit this morning. So they're a dime a dozen. So. But Terra Team, I think, brings up a good point where if you are working with these large Terralithic root modules, and you're have multiple teams working on that Terraform code itself, your team is slowed down. So if those teams are working on different parts of that Terralith that really have no impact on each other, they shouldn't be slowed down. This enables that by only locking the pieces of the state that are active, that are being modified by a given plan or a set of changes, if you will. But it doesn't speed up, like if you need to do a drift detection of everything, it's not speeding up drift detection. That said, I think it could open up possibilities for that, where now you have every single freaking resource in the database. Now you could have a Lambda or something else, a post process that's just refreshing the status of individual resources, and you don't need Terraform involved in the picture at all. One other
I was
aspect
just
of this. Oh, sorry,
saying,
go
yeah, I
on.
was just scrolling down at the visual interface section of the website you're on. At first, I was just thinking, oh, it's just going to be a plain old graph. How is that going to help? But I didn't expect it to show like the real-time status of resources is being created. That's really neat.
Right. So then you also get that because because it's the back end is talking directly to the database. So it can update the status of resources being worked on at that point in time, which is really interesting.
It is really responsive because I feel like with most tacos, you're kind of in the blind. Once you hit apply, you're kind of just going to wait and see what happens. Either it works or you're in for some painful time ahead. This, you have like a nice detailed overview in real time. Super neat.
Yeah, I think so. What was I going to say related to this?
Oh, like with the reporting and
Oh, well, refreshing the state of all of these, I think that's another really nice thing. You don't need Terraform to refresh the state of what is of if you have that ID of that resource in. And you have connectivity to that provider, you can now refresh that state without even using Terraform. So that this could even speed things up theoretically. Oh, two things I was going to bring up. So one of the interesting advancements in OpenTofu is you can now specify a target file which contains a list of resources that you want to target in your operations. That's in the same vein of how can we be more efficient with a Terralithic component, a Terralithic root module. So you take the new target list, you combine it with a state graph, and I think we're moving in a direction where you can do a lot, you can have much larger root modules. All right. And I guess the part I didn't mention is I assume that there and that you're maybe alluding to, Rishav, is that there might be a front end to this that lets you visualize what's going on by subscribing to the events in the Postgres database and seeing that visualization. So pretty cool. All right, any more questions before we move on from that one?
Can't wait to see them deliver, honestly.
Yeah. Maybe yeah, maybe yeah, if the Terra team wants to join office hours and share more about this, reach out to me.
It's also one of those things where you can see some folks kind of throw out some crazy old ideas, but it's nice when it's out of someone who's a little bit more established and been in this space for a wee while. Terra team, I think they've been here for a while, haven't they?
Yeah, they've been around for a very long time. They're pretty vocal on Twitter if you follow them. But I mean, yeah, it's a pretty well-researched piece at least. It's not just a puff piece from ChatGPT. So the next thing was just a little the thing that caught my attention was some of the challenges curl is having, and it struck a chord because I feel like we've started seeing some of these same pull requests. Not as vicious as the ones that curl is getting, but he basically describes that the curl project is getting inundated with these pull requests where somebody basically goes to, Claude Code or ChatGPT and says, find some condition in the curl library and make it sound totally, totally horrible, so that it merits, on the surface, at least a CVE, and the authors have to now spend valuable time from volunteers to research this report that just turns out to be frivolous. And we're seeing a bunch of these pull requests by security companies using open source as an avenue to promote their software, opening a pull request saying, like, this module doesn't hard code requiring a encryption at rest. Well, that's not a universal requirement. That's a best practice if you're storing secret information, or like just in some cases using a CMK could be a best practice, but it could also financially ruin you. So let's not generalize best practices for every single use case. Yeah, any thoughts on this? All right. Last topic. Actually, I forgot to dig deeper into this, partially because what else is new? Here's the 18 packages du jour this week that were compromised on NPM. You're welcome. Anyone read more into this one? All right. It's just sad how bad it is. But all right. That's all I got. Let's check the chat. Any links posted?
For NPM, I know Dino was something that came about from one of the co-founders, I think, of NPM, and one of their big things was no longer do you have to worry about upstream attacks. We have changed the whole model. You get to pick and choose what you want to package, but it's all packaged into your thing. It's not just pulling the latest that's available.
This was the service you brought up last week, Rishabh,
No,
or
this is Dino, completely new to me. I've not really used it. It's part of the full stack thing. I think it's spelled DENO. It's meant to be Node, but with the letters moved around because
oh, okay. And it's a registry of some kind.
it's very, very similar to NPM in as or sorry, Node.js, but it's coming at it a different way, in as much as the registry, the way it works, instead of you pulling packages from NPM registry and hoping for the best, fingers crossed, this you kind of have to test it, run it local or run it as part of your app, and only then does it actually deliver whatever you want to on your application. But yeah, it's one of those things, like I keep hearing about it and it has all these lovely things, but I don't know if what kind of adoption this is seeing, if this is
Yeah.
comparable NPM node.
And it makes me think of Bun, which is also another
Right.
re-implementation.
Yeah, that's another one. I
We
think
were
that
using Bun
one.
for a while, and then it took one of our developers like a week or 2 weeks to trace down a really esoteric condition on why one of our tests or several of our tests were failing. And just switching back to PMPM resolved it, and unfortunately, that's where we went. But that's what I wonder about these re-implementations. But I'm a little confused. It seems like Dino is bigger than what you're describing here, Rashad.
It is, yeah. I think you're probably better, more accurate with the bun comparison. I think it's one of those kind of changing the whole ecosystem out with, hey, instead of Node, you can use Dino instead. We do everything from the bottom up. I think that's probably a better comparison.
Anyone have other insights on Dino? Let's see. Yeah, so that's where we're at then. Tim shared another link to another set of, was it 40 packages that were compromised? I can't keep track of it anymore. 180 NPM packages hit with major supply chain via TinyColor. I did see that. I wonder how many of these would be mitigated with the GH token, using GH tokens. I've more narrowly scoped GitHub tokens. So, any questions we can get answered today? Anyone come armed with some problems they're grappling with? Elvis asks, is PPM.io affected by the security issue? I'm not familiar with PPM.io. Oh, got it.
Autocorrect.
I would assume that PMPM would be. I mean, the packages themselves were vulnerable, no? So installing the packages would be a problem, even if the vector was NPM that compromised them. Reading between the lines, I don't know. Right. What else can we discuss today? Anything interesting? Rashad, in your court, or Greg, were you about to say something?
Hi guys, can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
I'm joining the chat for the first time. Though I put it in my calendar for a while. It's just I never managed to join.
Welcome.
I've been working recently on kinda redoing an existing backend in a small startup. Before it was done on a one account, everything with compute running on Lambdas, and I've recently put again the foundations with a small multi-account setup with separate workloads. And the legacy kept as yet another broad workload app with addition of CI account storing TF plans, TF state, and artifacts, with addition of networking account that at the moment holds only hosted zones, since I don't have any need for VPCs. Since I as well use DynamoDB and Lambdas. I came across a few challenges like how to solve writing Terraform for multi-module setup, how to apply changes on the multi-module setup, and I came up with so the first part, to be honest, I'm working alone, so I kind of for the first time speaking about this with someone, and I never done this before, so I'm kind of looking for some feedback maybe.
Well, you came to the right place. We'll recap where you're at right now, and then let's get into the specific problem just so we keep everybody on board. So you've recently been replatforming your small startup, moving from a single account to a multi-account architecture, fully serverless, Lambdas, DynamoDB, no need for VPCs. You have presumably a few SDLC accounts, maybe dev staging and prod. You have a network account, an automation account. The automation account is where you're keeping your Terraform state and plan files. And now you're grappling with how to apply Terraform maybe across these accounts, or
I'm already doing it. I was curious of your opinion how I do it, because what I did is so for some of the accounts are split across few modules, at least two, because we on everyone I have baseline plus at least something else. In terms of how I apply state is that I don't use like I use vanilla Terraform with no TerraGrand, no other wrappers. I have dependencies between my Terraform states and between my modules, and what I did was kind of creating dynamic. I use Circle CI. I create dynamically. At the moment not dynamically, but for every module I have a separate workflow in Circle CI, and I set, you know, like a in the setup step which workflows should be activated. Depends on where changes are done. So I don't have, you know, the nice stuff like with the state, this tool you described with the full graph sequential, traversing the graph by resolving dependencies. This is one question.
So
what do you think about this approach? The second,
before we keep going, let's recap where we're at, just so we keep everyone following along. So what I hear is that you have things broken out. So you're using vanilla Terraform, but not everything is in a single Terraform root module. And then you are applying with CI/CD. In your case, you're using Circle CI, and you've dynamically generated Circle CI pipelines, if you will, that have that will apply specific, what's the word I'm looking for, paths in your graph, if you will.
It activates. Actually, I could do that. What you say that the plan apply is chained, but I do basically it basically creates workflow alone workflows per module. So it's just generates a random, variable set of workflows that contains only plan, plan and applies. But it depends on whether what's changed in the repo or which dependencies changed, it either activates workflow or not. So it's kind of, I couldn't find better solution for this without, using
basically
external.
You touched on why these other tools exist, if you will. The challenge with Terraform is it's really easy to do everything up until the point you do two things or three things, right? So you have two different root modules or 10 different root modules, or for example, in the architectures we deploy, there's like 50 to 100 root modules. And this is where the actual complexity comes in. You could put all of that in a single root module, and then we get into the problems that state graph is trying to solve, or you could break them apart, and then you need other tooling. So in your case, I'm gonna challenge, you're not using vanilla Terraform. Your wrapper is CircleCI. Right? So extra tooling, everyone who says they don't use wrappers with Terraform